This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with noted lawyer and policing scholar Paul Cheveny about New York City's Hanshu consent decree.
That case, the Hanshu case, is illustrative of a national problem, the problem of surveilling, videoing, and spying on people in peaceful demonstrations and protests, although there is no evidence of any criminality.
We'll also look at red light surveillance cameras. Some say they're causing accidents, while municipalities around the country pull in major profits.
Surveillance creep by cameras that catch you supposedly crashing a red light. It's happening in Minneapolis, it's happening in New York, and it's happening in states throughout the country.
Michael Smith and Michael Ratner will update us on Guantanamo's military tribunals, as well as the current state of democracy. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
I want to update listeners a little bit about what's going on with Guantanamo and a recent blow that happened to people's rights in the Supreme Court. As many of our listeners know, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a number of other lawyers, hundreds across the country, have been representing Guantanamo detainees for 5.5 years, 5.5 years in which they have never had a trial, never gotten to go to federal court to challenge their detention in what's called a writ of habeas corpus. Twice we have gone to the Supreme Court, and twice the Supreme Court has said, yes, you have the right of habeas. Twice the president has gone back to Congress and says, no, you don't. Sadly, this last round of Congress saying, no, you don't have the right of habeas, which they did in the Military Commission Act, we appealed again to the Supreme Court. And just last week, the Supreme Court declined to hear that appeal. Let me remind our listeners what was at stake in this third appeal by the Guantanamo detainees to the Supreme Court. What was at stake is whether people held, quote, outside the United States at Guantanamo Bay, which is like being in the U.S., at least for purposes of U.S. control of the place, whether those people, those detainees, 5.5 years there, have a right to go into court and say to the government, why are you holding me? And what the Supreme Court said is we are not going to hear that case. It was a decision in which they said we're just not going to hear full argument. Three justices said we want to hear argument. Two justices said, well, first you have to go through some kangaroo, they didn't use the word kangaroo, but some congressionally mandated process of some kind of military hearing at Guantanamo, and then maybe an appeal to the court. And maybe that's a substitute for habeas corpus. Well, it's certainly not a substitute. That's called a combatant status review tribunal. You can use evidence from torture. You don't have an attorney. It's basically a kangaroo tribunal. And two justices said, that's what we think people ought to go through. You need four people to hear a case in the Supreme Court. We only had three. And when I heard this decision, we actually, as the attorneys, naively, I now think, expected to win in the Supreme Court, expected the Supreme Court to hear review, and finally, after 5.5 years, two different Supreme Court victories, win. And look what we have now, kicked in the face. The people in Guantanamo there for another year without actually getting to court. Maybe we'll get there someday for them. But really, what's worrisome is not just that we lost and not just the effect on our clients, which is gigantic, but that essentially a keystone of justice in America, a keystone against a police state, a keystone against tyranny has basically been removed from our constitutional rights, taken away, nullified. And that keystone is the writ of habeas corpus. It's the one that says to the Bush administration or any government or any president or any king, if you put me in jail, I have a right to go to court and challenge that detention. And now the Supreme Court has said, in effect, oh, no, you don't. Or even if you may someday, we're going to allow the government to keep you into what I can only determine to be preventive detention year after year after year, preventive detention in which you have no way out, no exit, as Sartre would say, or as Kafka would say, a Kafkaesque situation. And that's where we are right now in America. It was a very terrible decision. It's called Bumidian. We struggle on in the Guantanamo cases. We're going to go through this nasty little appeals process that Congress has set up. But I can tell you all today that if we had hearings in federal court, if we had habeas corpus hearings, Guantanamo would be cleaned out in 24 hours. The government wouldn't even face them. So what we have set up now is an alternative system of justice. Right now it's for non-citizens, it's for Muslims, but tomorrow it could be for all of us. A sad note to really what has been a heroic struggle by both the detainees at Guantanamo as well as the lawyers and others representing them. And I'm here with our co-host, Michael Smith.
Well, lay it out for the listeners, Michael. If Bush or anybody in the executive branch deems somebody an enemy combatant, and I'm talking not just about foreign nationals, but also about Americans, you're deemed an enemy combatant. What rights do you have, and how does that compare to what rights did you used to have before 9/11?
Let's look at two categories. First, there's the right of non-citizens, which are either permanent residents that can be in the United States or people abroad. And they've been stripped of the right of habeas corpus. So they're done for. The president can pick you up, put you in some offshore prison, and that's the ballgame.
Can he torture you?
Well, he would say he wouldn't use the word torture, but the president would say he could use methods that are necessary to secure, quote, information, confessions in the so-called war on terror.
Can they use hearsay evidence against you?
They can first to keep you there. They can use hearsay evidence against you. They can use the results of torture against you, torture of other people. That's all allowable. They can keep you excluded from any kind of a hearing they give you.
Can you get your own lawyer?
You can't. You don't have a lawyer. You don't have a right to go to a federal court. You're simply tried by some military little commission, and it's not really trial. There's no charges. It's simply the charge that the president has already declared you're an enemy combatant, and all this little three-person military committee does is confirm that hearing, and they can do so with evidence from torture, with coerced evidence, with evidence from hearsay, with secret evidence, and without a lawyer. So essentially, you have a mass preventive detention system set up for non-citizens right now.
You got the same rights that you had in the year 1214, because in the year 1215, this great advance for humanity came into being, habeas corpus, where you could challenge the right of the government and ask the question, why are you holding me? Now they've wound the clock back to 1214.
That's correct. We've gone back from 1215 to 1214. In a period of over 800 years to go back the 1 year. And that's what we've done. We've destroyed what I consider to be the fundamental pillar of a democracy or a fundamental pillar of an executive or king that's accountable to the people and to the law.
Now, they've done this to non-citizens. But what about citizens like you or me?
Well, citizens are actually in an interesting situation also, and it's not, I don't mean interesting, in a very nasty situation. Citizens can still be declared to be an enemy combatant by the President of the United States. Now, some listeners may say, well, what does that mean? Well, it really means whatever the President says. It's defined, yes, in the Military Commission Act. Congress gave him the authority. Let's think about that for a second. This is not just a bad executive gone bad. This is a Republican Congress, but joined by a number of Democrats that said, President, you can name anyone you want as an enemy combatant, citizen and non-citizen. So the president can simply say, Michael Smith, you are an enemy combatant. Then what happens next?
Well, can they stick you in some, say, Navy brig off the coast of Maryland?
The answer is yes, they can stick you in a Navy brig off the coast of Maryland. As far as I know, they could stick you in a Navy brig off the coast of South America.
You're going to have a lawyer?
They would contest your right to a lawyer. that you would still have, technically, you have the right to habeas corpus if we can find you, or if we can find your family who knows you disappeared and we can represent your family, which is what the Center for Constitutional Rights did with Guantanamo. We then could bring a habeas corpus writ on your behalf saying, why is Michael Smith being held in that offshore prison? But let's look at what happens when we do that. Okay, they pick up Michael Smith. They put him in offshore prison. They declare him an enemy combatant. We don't really know you're gone, but your family complains to us. We say we'll represent your family, which is really representing you. We go to court. We then have the Jose Padilla story is completely instructive. American citizen, gets off a plane in Chicago, picked up as an enemy combatant, held for 4 years as an enemy combatant, and tortured, held at a military brig, I think in South Carolina. No rights, no lawyer, finally got him through his family, the right to have a lawyer, finally got that. The case gets to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to decide, this is within the last year, can an American citizen be held as, quote, an enemy combatant under this open definition, open-ended definition of the president? On the verge of the Supreme Court hearing that, 4 years he's been in, understand this, in isolation, in torture conditions, trying to say, you can't hold me. 4 years he gets to the Supreme Court, and then the government realizes, the Bush administration says, well, we may lose this case. This is a bad case for us. And what do? They then charge him with a crime in Florida, alleged involvement in some conspiracy of terrorism. So he no longer is in this, what you have to call a limbo land, or really a person without any legal rights, but who's biologically alive, a person who has no legal rights, but is still a person in some way. And they say, we're going to charge him with a crime in Florida. And he's no longer an enemy combatant. Now he's facing a criminal trial. And of course, he gets a lawyer and all the normal things you get in a criminal case. So we've never had the Supreme Court deal with the American citizen case. But they've certainly done a bad job in an American citizenship case, of getting that case decided quickly. They had that chance in the Padilla case to decide it actually 3 years ago in 2004, and they bypassed the chance because they didn't want to deal with the hard issue. So you have to put blame on the fact that they can do what they're doing to enemy combatants, citizen and non-citizen, really at the foot of President Bush, at the foot of Congress, and at the foot of the courts. That's all three branches. When you got all three branches against us, what do you got left? As Arthur Conroy said, you have the people left, and that's where we have to appeal to.
But what is so terribly troubling is that if democratic rights are taken away from people, and if the government beefs up its own spy apparatus and manipulative apparatus, how people, if all you got left is the struggle of the people and the government is preventing that, so you don't have the legislative branch, you don't have the executive branch, you don't have the judicial branch, and the people are trying to struggle and the government's preventing from doing that with the police state laws.
I think that's a really critical point, because the way we have is people struggle in this country, demonstrations, protests, speaking out. The best image for what's happened, you know, we talk about it a lot on this show, Michael, about what happens to protest, and we'll talk about it again today. And one of the things, if there's an image in your mind, it should be an image of the constitutional right to protest, to form organizations to protest, being in one of those pens that they put up when you do protest, a constitution and the people penned in and then trampled by horses, because that's the image of our right to protest, is trampling it by horses and destroying, really, fundamental right to protest. So it doesn't look at what it really says to us is, yes, it's difficult out there, but in some way it may not be as bad as it was a year or two ago. But on the other hand, the lesson is all of us that our liberty and fighting for it is a constant struggle. And it means in the face of this stuff, you still got to get out there and put your body on the line. In my view of the role of lawyers, the role of human beings is to put themselves, their bodies, between the oppressed and the oppressors. And we all know who the oppressors are.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Across the United States, from Minnesota to New York to Texas, a host of cities have installed automated systems to catch vehicles that run red lights. A photograph is taken of the speeding car's license plate, and a citation is sent to the owner. Owners can contest the tickets by showing that the car title had been transferred, or by telling people the name of the person actually driving at the time. In Minneapolis, the police who manage the program said it issued 26,000 tickets in 6 months and reduced accidents by 16% at the intersections where cameras were posted. In Minneapolis, the program has reached its own red light. In mid-March, the ACLU scored a victory in court when a judge found that the automated system, called Photocop, was illegal. Photocop ticketed vehicle owners, not the drivers, which violated uniformity of Minnesota laws governing moving violations. Today we are delighted to welcome Howard Bass, a Burnsville attorney who argued the case for the ACLU of Minnesota. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Howard.
Thank you for having me on.
Can you tell us about your particular case before we start discussing these automated systems in general? How did you get involved with this?
Well, I am an ACLU of Minnesota board member and volunteer attorney, and the ACLU of Minnesota selected a case involving a man named Daniel Kuhlman, who was charged with violating Minneapolis's Photocop ordinance. We represented him at the trial level, and we convinced the district court judge to dismiss the charges against him on the basis that the ordinance conflicted with state law. The city appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed the district court, and the city then appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court. We had oral arguments 3 weeks ago, and I received notice yesterday that the Supreme Court's opinion will be filed tomorrow at 1 o'clock p.m.
Now, let's just go into the facts for our listeners. Your client owned a car, but someone else was driving it through one of the stoplights?
Well, we never litigated the facts involved. This was a facial attack on the ordinance's constitutionality and legality. So there was never a determination as to who the driver was. My client was ticketed because he was the registered owner of the vehicle that was detected going through a red light through the use of a camera.
Well, Howard, I got busted on the West Side Highway for doing that, and I was not happy about it. But just saying you're not happy about it is not enough to win a case in court. What did you argue?
Well, we had numerous arguments. We raised various constitutional issues. We argued that the ordinance, by imposing absolute vicarious liability on registered owners, violated their substantive due process rights. We argued that the ordinance also violated procedural due process because it created a presumption of guilt rather than a presumption of innocence. It shifted the burden of proof from the prosecution to the accused, and it compelled the accused to testify in their own defense. None of those arguments, however, were decided at the district court or the Court of Appeals, nor were they considered at the Supreme Court. And the reason for that is, we also argued that the Minneapolis ordinance conflicted with Minnesota statutory law. And both the district court and the Court of Appeals held that the ordinance did conflict with state law because it violated a requirement that Minnesota traffic regulations be uniform and apply throughout the state, and because it reduced the state's burden of proof in prosecuting red light violations.
Well, Howard, I would agree with all those arguments, and it seems that they were very well advanced. But the thing that sticks in my throat is the Orwellian aspect of having all these cameras taking pictures of us and surveilling us in our private lives on various street corners. Is that kind of right of privacy something that you might argue?
We have not yet argued it in the courts of law. However, I have argued it in the court of public opinion, specifically in the Minnesota legislature. Historically, between 2001 and 2003, there were 5 bills introduced in the Minnesota legislature which would have enabled cities to use this type of technology to enforce red light violations. All 5 bills were defeated. This year, bills were introduced. I've lobbied. I testified in both House and Senate committees, and we had a victory a couple of weeks ago By a 7-6 vote, the House of Representatives Public Safety Committee defeated the bill, and most of my arguments there were based upon public policy concerns involving surveillance creep and avoiding taking a large leap towards that 1984 Orwellian society.
Let me ask you something. This is Michael Ratner speaking. I understand a lot of the surveillance creep issues, and I understand the issue of vicarious liability, that, you know, you're not the one who drove through the red light, therefore why should it be, just because it's your car, should it be you? But, you know, here in New York, which is, I guess, where this practice began, we have a big issue with people running red lights and hitting people in crosswalks. So how do you answer someone who comes up with that criticism, saying, look, at how many deaths are caused by running red lights and going through crosswalks? It's done all the time in New York, and maybe this will help.
Well, I answer that in two ways. The first is, we can be safe and we can be free from unwarranted government surveillance. There was a 2001 congressional report by House Majority Leader Dick Armey about red light cameras. Its findings were that the cameras are essentially a revenue-raising device by cities that do not increase the safety at intersections. They relied upon traffic engineering studies to conclude that the better way to make intersections safe is to increase the time that lights are yellow and to create an all-red interval. In fact, some of the studies indicate that red light cameras cause increased accidents because people slam on their brakes and then they're rear-ended.
That's a great answer, actually. That for the first issue, I like. And what was your second point?
Well, the other is, you know, Ben Franklin once said, those who would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. I think those who would sacrifice privacy for safety deserve neither. There's an alternative method of increasing safety at intersections that does not take us down that slippery slope towards an Orwellian society.
It's a really good answer. Thanks.
Howard, did you know that in Lubbock, Texas, they have actually delayed installation of red light cameras after they discovered that there were shorter timed yellow lights, and local residents felt that was an overt attempt to get more money because shorter yellows assure a steady flow of red camera ticket revenue?
I wasn't aware of that case in Lubbock, Texas, but that 2001 congressional report that I mentioned indicates that, according to Congress's study, that was the case, that many municipalities were actually decreasing the yellow interval and in order to generate more revenue and making the intersections, therefore, less safe.
We're speaking with ACLU attorney in Minnesota, Howard Bass, who's been litigating these Orwellian automatic cop cameras at intersections, and evidently this is now becoming a nationwide phenomenon. How many states, Howard, have these intersection cameras?
The best indication I have comes from a USA Today report about a month or two ago, and that article indicated that there are currently 250 communities in 22 states in the District of Columbia that use cameras to enforce either red light violations and or speeding violations.
When you couple this with the radio frequency identification chips and the data banks they're keeping,
and gunshot detection devices,
and safety cameras that are being installed across the country.
Yeah, I mean, where do you go to hide?
Neighborhoods.
There's something very fundamental here, and that's the right to anonymity. You can't have a democracy if the government's going to know everything you're doing at every minute. And that seems to me the scary thing about this surveillance creep.
Well, also, moving violations can raise individuals' insurance premiums and ultimately lead to suspension or revocation of license. So I would imagine that a lot of people pay these tickets.
Oh, they do. In the 8 months that the camera's functioning in the city of Minneapolis, more than 14,000 tickets were issued at $142 per ticket, generating more than $2 million in revenue.
And why the flat rate?
$142 per ticket. During those 8 months, as a result of issuing those tickets, more than 3,000 driver's licenses were suspended.
For your average person who goes to work and hopefully makes $100 a day, they work a day and a half for the government because some camera took a photo of them going through an intersection.
Or worse, took a photo of their car being driven by someone else. The placement of some of these cameras in downtown Minneapolis They're located in close proximity to hotels and restaurants that use valet parking. They go to hotels, they give their car to a valet, the valet runs a red light, then, you know, 6 weeks later, they get a ticket in the mail.
You know, that happened to me in New York. I got $1,000 worth of parking tickets, and I parked my car in a garage, and I had to sell the car to pay the tickets. It's in the old days when I was doing legal services work, and I wasn't making much money. I had to sell my car, and it came out a year later that a guy named Donald Manus, who was a crooked politician in Queens, had run this vast parking violation schemes, and lots of guys like me were getting tickets or we never deserved them.
Well, talking about whether you deserve them or not, isn't there a due process issue here? Because you can't appeal to a judge. This goes before a hearing officer, Howard?
No, these would go in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. These were deemed petty misdemeanor criminal violations. And you have a right to a trial before a judge. You don't have a right to a jury. But in all other respects, it's like a criminal trial. My legal research has indicated that this is the only case in which the courts have invalidated a photocop or photo speed type system. In most, if not all, of the other jurisdictions that have upheld the legality of these systems, the photo enforcement is much more like a parking ticket than a moving violation. It doesn't result in license suspension. It doesn't result in points on someone's driving record. It can't be used to increase their insurance rates. It's like a non-moving parking violation.
Yeah, that's what it is in New York.
And that's probably why it's withstood challenges in the courts.
Thanks to guys like you, Howard. Maybe these challenges will someday be successful from one end of the country to another. It's really good to know that you're out there fighting this kind of stuff. It really does give us the creeps to see these cameras going up everywhere.
Thank you, Michael. I agree with you.
And good luck with the decision.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thanks, Howard.
Yeah, thanks, Howard Bass from the ACLU, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
When you cast your eyes upon the skylines of this once proud nation, can you sense the fear and the hatred growing in the hearts of its population? And our youth, oh youth, are being seduced by the greedy hands of politics. The beaten generation, reared on a diet of prejudice and misinformation. The beaten generation, open your eyes, open your imagination. Sedated by the gasoline fumes and hypnotized by the satellites into believing what is good and what is right. You may be worshipping the temples of mammon or lost in the prisons of religion, but can you still walk back to happiness when you've nowhere left to run? The beaten generation, the beaten generation.
In New York City, since 1986, police must follow consent decree guidelines when investigating individuals engaging in First Amendment-protected activities. We may not have had these guidelines were it not for a lawsuit brought by Barbara Hanshu, a National Lawyers Guild member. Known as the Hanshu Settlement, it was agreed to in 1980 by a plaintiff class numbering in the millions, as well as with the New York City Police Department. 22 years after the settlement was signed, the NYPD asked to modify it, saying that it was too restrictive and would inhibit their terrorism investigation. And U.S. District Court Judge Charles Haight agreed with the NYPD, subsequently relaxing the guidelines. And what's happening in New York is also happening all around the country. Take Chicago, for example. In 2001, the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals stripped Chicago's consent decree, a consent decree that was signed 25 years ago. Now, city officials say it impedes their investigations of gang activity. No longer are police in Chicago deterred from spying on or even disrupting the constitutionally protected activities of political groups. We're joined today by Paul Chevigny, law professor at New York University and one of the lawyers involved in New York's historic Hanshoe lawsuit. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Paul.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Paul, it's been 36 years that you've been working on the Hanshoe Consent Decree. Can you tell our listeners briefly how it all got started and the long history in a nutshell?
Well, it got started early in the 70s, obviously, and it was a big case to try to attack the problems with police infiltration of political groups that became notorious in the 60s. So agents provocateurs tempting people to commit crimes and infiltrating organizations and distorting their political positions by participating in their political activities and spooking and intimidating people by implying the police presence. Those problems, which are familiar. So we brought the case on behalf of a number of plaintiffs, but also on behalf of a class of all the persons in New York City who are surveilled by the police. And that class was established as a class, still exists. And we hope to get tremendous relief out of the case. I mean, it was like the beginning of the world as far as that body of law went. And we thought we were going to try to get a warrant system and so on. But ultimately, the law, particularly in this circuit, ran against us on many points. And in the 80s, we settled it. And the consent decree was that the police couldn't surveil Simon pure political activity that had no criminal content at all. But if there was a mixture and they thought that somebody was using the political as a cover for crime, then they could surveil, but they needed the approval of this Hanshoe authority, which was a civilian and two people appointed by the police. So that actually was in effect for 15 years, more than 15 years, until shortly after the 9/11 tragedy, and the police came in and said, we have to do more systematic surveillance of political activity in the United States and New York, and we can't live under this consent decree anymore, so it's got to be changed. That was in 2002, and it was decided in 2003, and it brings us pretty much up to date. I mean, I can go on.
Paul, let me ask you. I remember the meeting where the Guild discussed this way back when both of us were younger. And the big issue then was those defending the Hanshoe Compromise was that at least we'll get a paper trail out of the cops. And if they do screw up, we can go back and find out what they did to us. What's become of that?
Oh, well, yes. Well, that was the principal thing. We thought that they would have to pause before they began a political investigation, and in addition, there would be a paper trail. The constitutional law on it wasn't very favorable. I mean, the constitutional law on the government's power to infiltrate groups is not very strongly protective. So this, we thought this wasn't so bad, although a lot of people disagreed with us. But so comes 2002, and the police said, in effect, we got to get rid of the consent decree completely. We should have no controls on surveillance. Fortunately, the judge, who is a decent guy, pretty much said, I can't really do that. I can't institute a decree which does nothing at all. That's not a decree, really. So he said, are you in effect asking for the case to be dismissed? And they didn't really say they were doing that. So they rushed in and they did something which at present turns out to be something that we thought it was pretty much of a disaster, and so did most everyone else, but it turned out not to be as bad as it looked.
Paul, could you briefly tell our listeners, what is a consent decree?
Oh, okay, that's a good question. You bring a suit to enjoin something, some bad thing from being done. You bring a suit to enjoin the police from doing agent provocateur activities or from overcrowding a prison, for example, and you litigate the case, usually on behalf of a class, and after a period of time, the defendants sometimes say, isn't there some place in the middle where we could compromise this? So a consent decree is a settlement. It's a settlement that has teeth in the sense that once it's consented to, it becomes the decree of the court so that the violation of it can be enforced by the court.
And there's no admittance of guilt on the part, in this case, say, of the New York Police Department.
Oh, no. They never admitted anything. That's a gift not worth having. I mean, we wouldn't have traded anything for their admission of something. We wanted them to do something. The police rushed in, and they proposed what are, in effect, the FBI guidelines for surveillance. Now, they changed the names, right?
These are the new FBI guidelines post-9/11 that were already a change from what we had won before, right?
And so they still have what we call a criminal predicate. In other words, you can only investigate political activity if there's a suspicion of a crime, and then there are various levels of investigation. There's a preliminary inquiry and a full investigation and so on. But it all requires the approval of the Director of Intelligence.
Director of Intelligence in New York City?
Yeah.
That guy's a CIA guy. They brought in the number three guy from the CIA in Washington and put him on us.
He's a former CIA guy. Well, we didn't like that at all. Now, the important thing is this is their proposal. This is not a compromise. We did not agree to this. We opposed it down the line.
And they're saying it was a compromise in the papers.
They are pretending that it's an agreement. And then not only did we oppose it, but we said, if you're going to put it in, at least make it part of the court decree so that if they violate it, we have some way of getting to court. And at first the judge refused, but the police were shown while the case was pending to have misbehaved by interrogating various people at a demonstration about their political beliefs and then pretending that they didn't know anything about it. So actually the judge incorporated it in the decree in August of 2003. So that's how we get to where we are now. In the intervening months, we found that the police were constantly videotaping demonstrations. And this is notorious. Those of your listeners who go to demonstrations know all about it.
Yeah, we see them with their tripods, with video cameras. And I always wondered about that in relationship to the decree.
Well,
I couldn't understand what they were doing, actually.
The decree, from our point of view, the decree said that if they were doing this, they had to be doing it as part of an investigation. And if they were doing an investigation, then they had to have the approval of the Director of Intelligence.
He is a former CIA guy, right?
Yes, he is.
And what's always interesting to me is, I know you're familiar, after the 70s, the CIA was essentially prohibited from operating in the United States.
I know.
And what they did is they just switched the jobs. They moved the CIA guys into domestic surveillance jobs, but didn't give them the name CIA.
Well, there are several great slippages in the protections of people. One of them is that the CIA is active in domestic surveillance, as is the Army, but also
both of which are supposed to be illegal.
It's unfortunate. I mean, the Army, or the military rather, generally is doing a lot of work against civilians, both in the United States and elsewhere.
Anyway, take us back to the decree. So guys are now at this point.
So we claimed that they were acting in violation of the decree. Well, the first thing they said was, we don't think the decree is enforceable. We don't think the court ever really said that the decree was enforceable. And if it is enforceable, these lawyers don't have the right to do anything about it. We got a decision recently from the judge in February where he said the decree is enforceable. It's part of the old decree from 2003, and these lawyers have the right to raise the issue. So now they come back. The police got extremely excited about it, and they're trying to get the judge to change his ruling. And actually, one of the questions that we had in our minds was, why are they so excited about this? Suppose they followed their own guidelines and they got the approval of the Director of Intelligence to do these things. That would be a little bit of work for Cohen, the Director of Intelligence, and maybe he thinks he's too swell for it. But, I mean, it's really not a big deal. They came back, and they had the face to say to the court, if we had thought that these guidelines were enforceable, we would never have agreed to them. Can you imagine saying that to a federal court? Well, of course, they didn't agree to them. In fact, they proposed them, and the court decreed them. It's no deal. It's not a consent decree. It was crammed down the throats of the plaintiffs. But now they don't want to abide by it.
What do you think is going on?
Yeah, well, these things that came out in the Times, I think, tell us the solution. And also, there's recent reports in the Washington Post about the D.C. police and the FBI together. Mm-hmm. I think they want to do Simon Pure political surveillance. They want to do political surveillance that has no criminal predicate, as we say.
It's called preemption of risk.
They want just to find out what people are thinking.
They want to know everything about us, and the obverse is we can know nothing about them. They become opaque, and we become transparent.
So you think this is what they've been doing. Is that it?
Yeah, and I think that's the reason that they don't want to apply to – it isn't that they don't want to apply to the director of intelligence. It's that they don't want to comply with the standards. Yeah. In other words, they don't want to do it based upon the fact that they suspect a crime. They want to do it based on the fact that they want to know what billionaires for Bush thinks and why they think it and who they are and who, you know, where their money comes from, if any.
So this isn't just a New York City issue. This is going on in Washington.
Well, yes. There's another thing about the New York police is they're I think there's a lot of ego involved. They feel that they're very important. I mean, Kelly has taking a public position that the New York police is doing a better job than the feds do of investigating terrorism. You've probably read those stories. And they've sent police all over the world to investigate things. So I think they feel that they're the king of the hill and nobody has any business telling them how to do anything.
But with the revelations that came out front page New York Times in the last couple of years of police actually doctoring videotapes during the RNC, is there no shame to the fact that they've been exposed for having misused these videotapes, giving it to the lawyers after they doctored them?
Well, I think the short answer to that is no. The changing of the videotapes hasn't received nearly as much publicity as it should have, partly because that RNC case, unfortunately, has been conducted under wraps. You know, the city made a motion to keep the proceedings sealed, and they have succeeded in that. And that always makes a case very difficult to conduct, and it's hard to understand what's going on. But what can I say? The police, listen, well, I'll lay it on the line. The police falsify things all the time, and they have done so time out of mind. It's nothing new, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with politics. It's a problem with respect to the way that police work is conducted and has been forever, as far as I know, certainly all my working life.
We've been talking with Paul Chevenier, a constitutional lawyer and a professor of law at NYU Law School.
And one of the lawyers in the Handshoe case. Paul, so we're going back up to date with the consent decree. So now what do you expect to happen next in court? Here you have them saying, we don't want to have to comply with this, essentially. Right. And the judge saying, as the judge said, yes.
Well, the argument's going to take place on the 11th of April, but the judge already said that they have to comply with it.
What's the argument about then?
The argument is that they basically want the judge to back off from that. And they're trying to get him buffaloed into doing that. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, what the judge is going to decide. I mean, since he's already decided that they ought to comply with it, I think we're in a fairly good position.
And what happens next? Let's say he does decide you have to comply, or the police have to comply with the order. Is there a discovery that you're going to find out what they did in the case?
Well, we'll try that, but I'm afraid the next step is going to be that they will appeal. I don't know on what grounds. I think his decision is fairly clear. And it's actually fairly narrow. He's interpreting a document which they presented to him, and he's interpreting his own decisions from the past. He's not really interpreting the Constitution. I mean, it's a good thing that this happened, but it's actually, as a legal matter, it's rather narrow and technical.
Now, right now in the streets of New York, next demonstration, what restrictions are the police under? Are they under the order? Consent order? Are they still surveilling people? What can we expect?
It's not clear that it's been stayed with respect to that, so I don't know exactly whether the police. There was a short period of time when the police were actually not filming, and then the cops came back and the city came back and moved to reopen it, and it's not clear what the status is while the motion is pending.
Paul, if our listeners want to come hear these oral arguments on April 11th in the federal courthouse, where do they go?
They go to 500 Pearl Street, which is in back of the old federal courthouse. It's the new courthouse. And they ask for Judge Haight's courtroom, H-A-I-G-H-T. And the argument is at 2 p.m.
Do you think they'll be surveilling the people coming in?
Probably not.
Let's hope
Paul, can you tell us, aren't the police required to destroy the videotapes 1 year? They're not.
Absolutely.
But they have
not
to keep them 1 year.
One of the things we asked for was we asked that they not be permitted to do it. But we said, for Pete's sake, if they do it and they want to learn something from it, why don't they destroy them after that? And they refused to accede to that as well.
So the fear is that they're keeping these and developing profiles of individual activists who appear at various marches in New York City or at protests.
Yes. They say they're not doing that, but I don't see any reason why we should believe them.
Let me ask one question about the FBI guidelines, because that's what these New York City consent guidelines are based on.
Yes.
Do you think the FBI is going beyond their guidelines as well in terms of not having some kind of criminal predicate?
We heard a story that the FBI said we would not do this the way that New York police are doing it. On the other hand, the story that comes from D.C. about the FBI participating together with the D.C. police indicates to me that they may well not comply with their own guidelines. Now, they don't have a court decree, which is, as far as I know, they have no court decree which makes their guidelines enforceable. I mean, the fact that they violated their own guidelines, as we like to say, that plus $2 will get you on the subway. You know, it's not a...
Let me ask about the political context, first in New York City and then nationally.
Sure.
Is there any movement in our city council of New York? Is there any movement in Congress on any of these issues?
Yeah, that's a good point. There is a move in the city council. It's not strong at the moment, but there is a move to try to create a set of requirements that the police make reports to the city council, similar to the reports that they made concerning stops and frisks. We just started to discuss that, and actually that's very hard to work out. Another proposal that's been made that I think is more attractive is that there be a kind of inspector general. In other words, there should be a person independently appointed by the mayor who is an inspector general in the police and will call their attention, the police's attention, to the fact that they're not complying with regulations and guidelines. This is a so this is not civilian complaints or anything like that. This is a kind of auditor who is trained and skilled and who is there and has a staff, and such a person can suggest policy changes to the police and could also suggest that they change their behavior to comply with the rules as they are. That's a wonderful idea. It's actually a big deal.
There's been some success with that on the federal level. Glenn Fine, who's at the Justice Department, has given very good reports on particularly domestic roundups after 9/11 and some other issues.
There are such people in police departments elsewhere in the country. Mm-hmm. Generally, they've been brought in after terrific scandals.
Let me ask you this. After 35 years of doing this, what's your feeling about the state of where we are on preventing surveillance of protests, domestic groups? Are we advanced?
We're in bad shape. I don't think we're in as bad shape as we were a year or two ago. I think that with the spirit draining out of this administration and the opposition to the war, I think it is also true that people feel that the reaction to terror has been somewhat overblown, and that people's liberties are actually quite important. I think that feeling is appearing, I mean, not only in the New York Times, but elsewhere in the Washington Post. And I think it's becoming stronger than it was immediately after 2001. I don't think we're in very good shape, but I don't think we're in as bad shape as we were a couple of years ago. I also don't think we're in as bad shape as we were in the 50s. You know, back in the days when they used communism as a scare, it was actually much worse. People thought anything goes as far as the communists were concerned. And it doesn't seem to be quite that bad now.
Well, if I was sitting in Guantanamo and being detained as a enemy combatant, I'm not sure I'd agree with you.
Well, I was... Okay. Well, point well taken. But I was thinking about domestic surveillance. I wasn't thinking about people allegedly arrested.
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with you on that either, respectfully, Paul, given the high-tech stuff, the toys they've got to play with now that they didn't have 50 years ago, everything from radio frequency identification chips, cameras, data banks, data mining, I think they got us covered from A to Z. They know everything about us, and we know nothing about them, and that's what worries me.
Well, that's you're undoubtedly right. The technology is a lot more powerful. I mean, the business about cameras everywhere, I mean, there are stationary surveillance cameras absolutely everywhere, right?
Yeah.
We aren't even litigating that issue. We did that 35 years ago without any success. I mean, the police say, if you can see the Chrysler building, we can see you.
Oh, no.
So that's probably true. So, you know, if you're going to smoke a marijuana cigarette, think twice.
If our listeners want to help on this handshoe challenge, is it something they can do? Is there a website?
They can get in touch with, I don't think we don't have a handshoe website. I mean, they can contact one of the lawyers. It's me, Paul Cheveny, Jethro Eisenstein, Franklin Siegel, or the New York Civil Liberties Union. We're all in it together, and also Martin Stoller. So, S-T-O-L-A-R. So any of us, we're always delighted to talk about it.
What's remarkable to me about the video stories, again, is, you know, when I was at law school just around this time, 68, 69, 70, and of course they took pictures of all of us at every demonstration. They kept big mug books and had all our pictures in it to leave through. And, you know, a lot of the law students refused to go to demonstrations because at that time to get through the bar, you know, the police would make a report on you and you would have trouble getting through the bar character exam.
Right.
What I can't believe is that we're basically reliving that,
right,
you know, some
well,
35
we're reliving
years
it, but
later.
Curiously, because they're having made this proposal, apparently without having really read it, or anyway, they didn't think it through, we now seem to have at least a shred of protection against it.
In what way?
Which is great. Well, in the way that they have to follow their own guidelines and get the approval of their own people before they do this, and they have to do it based upon a good reason. It's rooted in some sort of suspicion of crime.
And is there documentation if they have a good reason that
well,
we
they
can
have
get?
To, yeah, it's written. They have to make a written application to get written approval.
You think we could sue them for damages for this?
No. I mean, actually, the judge passed on that we can't handle a damage case based on this. And according to the decision, there isn't any damage remedy that's available based upon these decrees. It's either injunctive or it's nothing.
So if they
that doesn't mean you can't sue them.
No,
but you can't sue them under this case.
But if they infiltrate our organization, Friends of Heidi for Peace, and they infiltrate us and they mess us over and they cause us problems.
You mean to say the Friends of Heidi are for peace?
Well, some of her friends are. But in any case, if they infiltrate us and they disturb the organization and we want to sue, what you're saying is that we can't sue for damages.
Oh, not at
conjunction.
All. If they do something that violates the Constitution, like infiltrating an organization for the purpose of interfering with your rights of free expression, that's a violation of the Constitution and you can bring a suit. It's not very easy to win because it's pretty hard to prove, but that's a separate action. The point is that under this particular decree, you don't have any damage remedies.
Right. If I'm videotaped at the last demonstration I was at and I say, well, that was a violation of the decree, I can't sue because it was a violation of the decree.
No, you can't. But you can come right to us and we can make a motion to disappear the films and
right
all that kind of stuff. I don't know whether we'll succeed with it, but we'd be delighted to do it.
So, again, the argument is April 11th. Where, Paul?
A district court in the Southern District of New York, 500 Pearl Street, Judge Hates courtroom.
Well, thank you, Paul, for staying with this case for 30, how many years now, Paul?
36 years.
And still
lifetime
counting.
But we get along well. The plaintiff's lawyers get along well. We have a good time doing
right
it. And it's the thing that glues us together. We're going to stick with it. Also, we like the judge. I don't know whether he likes us or not, but he seems entertained by us. He sort of treats us like an afternoon movie. He puts us on for argument in the late afternoon, and he lets the argument run on until everybody's tired.
It's great because there's people who are on this videotapes now of the police department who weren't born at the time of the consent decree. Many people.
Many, right, many people.
Right.
Probably half the population of America, and certainly New York City. Anyway, Paul Cheveny, one of the lawyers on the handshoe case, we all owe you a big debt of gratitude, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Historically, court settlements and consent decrees have held in check unfettered police abuse of First Amendment freedoms. But under the Bush administration,
attorneys general have actually marginalized these important decrees. We've watched the Justice Department lift consent decrees, preferring to enter into less formal understandings with police. In so doing, the judicial branch of our government acts as a national conspirator with local police departments in violating all of our collective civil rights.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.